Welcome to the West Elk Word. I'm Tony Todd, here today with Dr. David Hyde, professor of anthropology at Western Colorado University. He's here today to tell us a story about Native ancestral repatriation, a fancy way of saying giving bones back to the land and people they came from. Dr. Hyde, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about these bones. They exist here at Western, and they're about to go home, or as close to home as we know we can get them. Where are they from? How old are they? And how long has Western had them?
Okay, so a lot in that question. Let's see. I'll try to unpack it bit by bit. So the C.T. Hearst Museum that is here at Western have the remains of 43 Native American ancestors. The museum and Western Colorado University acquired them in a variety of ways. All of these individuals came into this collection prior to any of the current faculty, even the recently retired faculty. Most of them were taken out of the ground back in the 20s and 30s, maybe a little bit into the 1940s. But the vast majority are from unprovenienced, non-permitted treasure hunters, pot hunters, head hunters, that sort of thing. So there's 43 individuals. 25 of them came to our museum as the result of one individual back in the 1930s who was digging up archaeological sites near his house down in the Durango-Cortez area. He passes away in the 1940s, I believe it was, late 1940s, and his brother, who was an alum of Western, taking care of the estate, didn't know what to do with all, it was skulls, nothing post-cranial, and about 150 pieces of pottery. So he didn't know what to do with them. He went to Western, called up Western. There was no archaeologist or anthropologist here at the time. Someone picked up the phone and said, yeah, we'll take them. And they remained in boxes covered in papers, newspapers, and things like that until 1989 when Mark Steiger got here, sort of the first archaeologist to be hired. And then he started, you know, sort of showing them a little more respect, taking them out of the boxes and as best we can, at least, given that they're in a museum and not where they should be. Others were excavated by permit. There was a professor here in the 1930s and 40s by the name of C.T. Hearst, which is what the museum is named after, as well as the Hearst Building. He's actually a biologist who got interested in archaeology, and he went and got some permits and did excavations around the Southwest in Colorado at Tabwash Cave, Cottonwood Cave, and some other places. And so in the case of those excavations, they encountered some human remains and brought them back. And so some of them are that way. But the vast majority are from those sort of looting, treasure hunting contexts that they just got donated to us a long time ago. And so we're trying to get them home, kind of cleaning up the messes of the past and so forth.
Finding out where home is isn't so easy, is it?
Yeah, and so like I said, some of these are in archaeology we call it provenience, which is that sort of three-dimensional space from which something that we dig up comes from. So it can include everything from the actual site, where within the site, the unit from our excavations, that's provenience. It's all that kind of control. And the looters, the folks who are digging these things up, who aren't archaeologists, they don't take into consideration provenience, right? They're just looking for things. And so it's hard to determine exactly where some of these ancestors come from, but when there's associated artifacts that go with it, like the pottery is a good indicator of time and place, right? It's just like anything else, even today, cars, et cetera, the styles change, right? Like you can look at an old picture that you find in your parents' basement or something, and you're going to have a pretty good idea of at least maybe the decade it was taken by the clothing, hairstyles, et cetera. And the pottery is the same way, just like the stone points and those kinds of things. They are of a particular area as well as a particular time. So it helps us narrow down who they might be the ancestors of, but it's not perfect.
Is there a way genealogically to do that?
So doing the DNA testing, especially ancient DNA testing and so forth, I cannot do that unilaterally. So I couldn't do it legally, and I also wouldn't be able to do that ethically or morally and so forth. That is a destructive analysis, so you have to break some of that bone down and so forth. And so that's absolutely illegal. In order to get any kind of DNA testing done, it would require a lot of consultation with a lot of different Native American communities, tribal communities, and getting their permission. And so they all have to kind of be in agreement. And in general, it's my understanding, at least, that most tribal communities do not want the DNA testing because it is destructive. It's sort of a continuation of unethical colonial practices of the past and not the way that they think ancestors should be treated.
And many,
to break them up.
Many Native cultures hold the bones of humans as sacred and containing the spirit and essence of that person. So to do that, when you look at it from that perspective,
correct,
it really changes your view on whether it's worthwhile or not.
Yeah.
Is there a way to determine, just from a structural standpoint? I think what made me think of this was not so long ago, I had an endodontist. I was going to get a tooth implant, and she asked me if I was Scandinavian.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, how do you know that? And she said, your bone structure. So I was wondering if you can tell from just the way the bones are kind of look, or their length, or, girth or whatever.
Yeah, not necessarily. There's some features you can look at to determine if this particular set of bones, if this individual is Native American or likely to be Native American. A lot of it has to do with the teeth.
Mm-hmm.
There's a particular morphology of Native American teeth. It's called a shoveled incisor that is shared with some populations in Asia, around Mongolia, which is where most anthropologists, evolutionary anthropologists, et cetera, think that Native Americans sort of originate from some of those populations. And so as a result of founder effect, small population that carried the alleles that code for shoveled incisors, that small population came into the Americas, crossed the bridge, the land bridge, and then that trait spreads throughout the population. So whether it's North America, Central America, South America, almost all indigenous persons will have those shoveled incisors. So if those are present, we can at least say, yes, this person is most likely Native American. But with the bones themselves, there's so much variety and variation, biological variation among Native populations, right? They're not homogenous in that sense. So depending on where within the U.S. they might have first settled and lived for thousands and thousands of years, you're going to have lots of differences.
And speaking of those thousands of years, do you have any sense for how old these are?
It varies. The majority of them are probably about going to date to about 1100 CE, maybe a little bit older, maybe a little bit younger, but 1,000 years or so.
You've recently completed an inventory.
Yes.
That was a big job. Tell us what that entailed.
Yeah, so all of this is part of compliance with a law called NAGPRA. And so NAGPRA is the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. It has two parts to it. And sort of, it was passed in November of 1990. The graves protection is sort of moving forward with any new discoveries after the law. And so in those cases, if during a development project, right, pipelines, whatever, and human remains are encountered and they're likely to be Native American, the whole project stops and this NAGPRA process kicks in terms of consultation and so forth. Now, the other half is the repatriation part, and that's really dealing with everything that happened before 1990. And it required all institutions that have archaeological material, and if they're from federal lands, if the federal money is coming to that museum or institution and so forth, they have to do this process. And that process was to inventory absolutely everything in the repository, in the entire collection. And so for some museums, that's millions and millions of objects. And so they had to do that and then provide an inventory of everything in the collection that would fall under NAGPRA. So NAGPRA includes the human remains, but also funerary objects, objects of cultural patrimony, sacred objects, these kinds of things. So it's more than just the bones, right? And so once that inventory is completed, it goes out to all Native American tribes. So in 1990, when the law was passed, it was every federally recognized tribe. It's been amended a number of times. And then you wait to hear back from them, see if they have any questions and so forth. And then what we just completed is, so that inventory was done back in the 90s, and no claims were made. There was also one of the other issues that took place in the 1990s for us is that there wasn't true consultation that took place. Some phone calls were made, actual visits by representatives, and you know, a lot of the tribes didn't have NAGPRA coordinators yet and these kinds of things. It was so new. So in the 90s, the university made an attempt. Didn't happen. So what I did when I started working on this project in 2022, got delayed by COVID and some other things, but 2022 is when I started getting involved in the NAGPRA component of the museum. And so we did a new inventory. So I didn't want to send the old inventory to the different tribal communities and so forth. I wanted to make sure I knew exactly what we had in the museum there. So we created a new inventory, sent that out in late 2022 while we were working on a grant.
Did you send that to everybody or just the Native tribes of the Southwest where you suspected?
Mostly in the Southwest. Yeah, mostly throughout the Southwest. We ended up sending notifications to, I think we sent out about 60 notifications throughout the Four Corners area, and asking if they wanted to partner with us, sort of explaining the context of the ancestors that were in the Hearst Museum, as well as some of the other items that would fall under NAGPRA and so forth, where we think they came from. And we were really focused on that Peterson collection because that was the majority of the ancestors in the collection. And then as we move forward, we've included all of them. So we did a new inventory, sent out the 60 or so letters, and a number of tribes wrote back to us to say, yes, they would like to partner. They were added to the grant, and then that was submitted in March of 2023. And then in the fall of 2023 is when we got the award. And so with that, we then did the consultation. We had representatives from a number of different tribes come to Gunnison and as a group sort of talk about the collection, whether they wanted to make individual claims or group effort and those sorts of things. And then after the consultation, you have to send yet another inventory into National NAGPRA, to the federal government, indicating cultural affiliation. Once that is approved, then it goes to the notice of inventory completion, which is what we just submitted about a month or so ago. And that's where we have our inventory and this document, this notice of inventory, gets uploaded onto the Federal Register. And the Federal Register used to be printed, it's all digital now, but everything that the government does and every legal action, et cetera, gets put up on that website. And so our NIC went onto the Federal Register on April 2nd. It has to be there for 30 days. And after that time period, then in this case, Native American tribes, et cetera, the different communities, can then make claims to have them repatriated back to them. And so that's where we are now. So we've done our 30 days. The consultation is still ongoing with all these different tribal representatives to determine sort of where to rebury these individuals. And, you know, we've got a couple of locations that are probably going to work out. Our collection is 43 ancestors from different states. And so that's why we're going to possibly have a couple of different reburial sites that are selected for. And it's up to the tribal representatives that we're working with to determine where they go.
Who are those tribes?
We have been working with the Southern Ute Tribe, the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe, the Navajo, the Hopi, and the Pueblo of Zia. So that's who I've been working with more directly. But some of the other institutions that we're sort of involved with have a couple of others that have been brought in as well.
Is that going smoothly? I know that historically some of those tribes haven't always gotten along. So are they working well together?
It is. The meetings have been very productive, and you know, there's no real infighting or anything like that. I mean, we all want the same thing. You know, they certainly want their ancestors to come home and to be reburied and to be able to fully rest. And we want the same thing. You know, we don't think they should be in these cabinets on a campus any longer.
If you are just joining us here today on the West Elk Word, I'm Toni Todd, here with Dr. David Hyde, Professor of Anthropology at Western Colorado University. Dr. Hyde is leading a project to repatriate the remains of Native people from a collection of bones held at Western since 1946. I think one of the things that's maybe confusing for folks is they often wonder why this is so complex. Why does it take so long? But you kind of just explained that to some extent. There's a lot more to this than just putting them in a box and giving them back to the people where they came from. But maybe you can elaborate on that a little bit more. There are thousands of these collections across the country at universities, at museums. Yeah. And so just based on the scope of that, it's complex. But even just between Western and local Native tribes, it's complex.
Yeah, so we got the grant in the fall of 2023, and it took, I think it was into 2025, early 2025, before we had our first consultation. You know, so after we were awarded the grant, I emailed all of the tribes that wanted to partner with us and so forth, and let them know that we had gotten the grant and that I would like to then set up a time where I could drive down there to have the first face-to-face conversation be where they are rather than either over a Zoom or force them to come up here, that kind of thing. But I figured the best thing to do would be for me to go down there. And after close to a year of trying to coordinate, we decided to just start doing some Zooms after all, sort of one-on-one with each individual tribe. And then we were finally able to get everyone's schedules to align so that representatives from the various tribes could come up here and we could have that conversation, that consultation in person, look at the collection, these sorts of things. But something to keep in mind, we are one institution, as you mentioned, and there's all these thousands and so forth out there. And so most tribes will have a NAGPRA coordinator, and it may just be one or two individuals that are part of that team. And they're getting emails from me all the time, but they're getting emails from everyone else whose museum is trying to be in compliance. But they're also doing that other half of NAGPRA that we talked about, the graves protection part. And so we might have a meeting planned, but then at some development site, some construction site, human remains were found, and they have to kind of drop everything. And, you know, that takes priority because it has to be dealt with right now.
Urgent.
Yeah. And so that's where some of this stuff gets delayed, or at least making it a longer process. There's been turnover. You know, not all tribes have a lot of money, a lot of resources. Just since I've started this, a number of the tribes, the representative, the individual that I've been communicating with has changed a couple of times. You know, people retired, someone else was in the position. In some cases, as was the instance with me, the new person in that position hasn't worked on NAGPRA before, right? So there's a learning curve that they have as well as I have a learning curve. And this is the first time I've done NAGPRA compliance. And I remember calling up one of the representatives, the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, or TIPO, calling the TIPO, and we got to talking about it, and one of the first things he said to me is, I hope you've done a whole bunch of these, because I've never done this before. And I just, you know, sort of laughed back, and it's like, yeah, me either, we're going to have to learn it together kind of thing. You know, so those are all things that have to be taken into consideration. They're getting huge stacks of requests to partner with institutions, to do consultation, and they get stretched really thin as well. And so those are some of the factors, as well as the sort of bureaucracy we talked about earlier and these various steps that have to be done. And they got to be just right. You know, I sent in my notice of inventory completion. I had to correct a couple of typos before they would accept it, right? I mean, it's really, really strict.
I imagine it's complex from the native side, just from a decision-making standpoint, too. Once you get through all the bureaucracy and all the paperwork and all the forms and all the submissions and all the waiting periods, at some point, they have to make a decision. And that's maybe the hardest thing of all.
Well, that's an excellent point. In some of the consultations that we've had, a comment was made of, you know, just sort of in a discussion about should these ancestors go to this potential location or this one, and what do you want us to do, kind of thing. And at one point, one of the tribal representatives sort of said, you know, it's really unfortunate we have to clean up your mess. Like, you're putting all of this on us. Now, now NAGPRA gives them agency, which they never had before, but it's also then they're responsible for cleaning up all these things in the past that Euro-Americans have done and so forth, and making those tough decisions. I mean, they're decisions about their ancestors, but it's like, I shouldn't have to be doing this. If you didn't do these things that you did in the past, you collectively, right? And so, yeah, it's pretty tough decision. You know, these are human beings that are their ancestors, and they've been treated so poorly, and, you know, they just want them to get their final resting place, and we have to go through all this, unfortunately. Fortunately, but fortunately, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's, and like, they're not wrong.
They're not wrong at all.
It's just unfortunate we can't turn back the clock and do things right instead.
Yeah.
So I understand there's now an agreement between the Native tribes and the Bureau of Land Management.
Yeah, I don't want to get into too many details of the where and all of that. It's the Bureau of Reclamation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Not Bureau of Land Management.
Yes. Okay. One of the regional heads of the Bureau of Reclamation is the one who's kind of managing it, the logistics, and kind of coordinating and so forth. And that one involves multiple federal agencies, land management agencies, Corps of Engineers, right? The ones who actually, the federal agencies that are moving dirt. And numerous museums and numerous tribes. And so that potentially will be a very, very large reburial that's scheduled to take place in the fall. And I'll just kind of leave it at that. And so some of the ancestors in our collection may go there, especially the ones that are from New Mexico. And then there's another potential location in Colorado where many of the other ancestors will go.
Okay.
And that one isn't quite as big, but it is still multiple institutions and multiple tribes that are involved.
So as long and arduous as this has been, they're starting to look like there are going to be some physical locations and possibly some ceremonies to help commemorate this at some point in the near future.
Yeah, absolutely. In both instances, it'll be in the fall. For one, we have a scheduled time and place that we're preparing for. And then the other location will also be sometime in the fall, just not.
Dr. Hyde, why is this important? And especially, why is it especially important to you? And why should it be maybe more important to the rest of us?
Well, I mean, it's important for so many reasons. I mean, there's the ethical, the moral, the humanity of it. This was the result. NAGPRA was the result of a very hard-fought civil rights movement by Native Americans back starting in the 1960s, but really kicked it into gear in the 60s along with other civil rights movements. So we have the American Indian Movement and so forth. And they fought for decades to get some sort of control. And NAGPRA is a civil rights legislation. It's not an antiquities or archaeology law. It's civil rights. It's giving these rights back to Native Americans to control over what happens to their heritage and to their ancestors, like the physical remains of their ancestors. And it's really important to me because, you know, the things that have been done to Native Americans in the history of Euro-American colonization and so forth is just absolutely tragic. And it's a way to try and close a book on that and get some real healing for the Native American groups. We need to own up as museum directors, curators, as archaeologists and so forth, and take these human beings out of cabinets in a university and put them in the ground near their descendants where they belong, and they can get that final resting. It's just, it's inhumane that they're still in these cabinets. You know, it's heartbreaking.
I often think that if we could just imagine these roles reversed.
I was going to say that.
If someone were to roll in with a bulldozer into Arlington National Cemetery and start to dig and decide, oh, gosh, the bones of soldiers, I think we'll go and study them and put them in a museum somewhere. I think we would be able to maybe empathize with the native people's
feelings
on this.
Some of it is absolutely even worse than that, where, you know, with Manifest Destiny and the clearing of the West after the Civil War, the cavalry goes out and, you know, they're having these battles with Native Americans. And as they're you know, freshly dead on the battlefield, you have the medical personnel that are with the cavalry who are required by the government to desecrate those bodies and send them back east to the museums. So, I mean, they're still fresh on the battlefield. And those individuals, those ancestors, are in museums today. I mean, so there's a really just horrific story behind many of the ancestors that are in museums across the country. A lot of them have been returned, but there's still a lot of work to be done. So, I mean, yeah, you reverse that, and there's just no way. And I forget who the Native American scholar was. It might have been Roger Echohawk, who said, if you dig up a white man, you go to jail, right? Dig up a white man's grave, you go to jail. You dig up an Indian, they give you a dissertation. They give you a PhD, right? It's completely, you reverse these roles and no, you know, but it was all part of that dehumanization and ethnocentrism that was so rampant, certainly in the 1800s and early 1900s. And that's when a lot of this looting and grave robbing, and in the case of the Peterson collection, was literal headhunting, right? Because it's just the skulls. There are no post-cranial remains just to put up in their house. So all of that needs to be corrected. And that's, again, just why it is so important.
Well, Dr. David Hyde, professor of anthropology at Western Colorado University, thank you so much for spending some time with me today here on the West Elk Word.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about this process.
That's it for this edition of the West Elk Word. You can listen to this or any edition of the program anytime. Go to kbut.org, click Programs, then West Elk Word. Thanks for listening. See you next time.